Oxygen is carried to the brain in the blood. Blood pumped, of course, by the heart. If the brain isn't getting enough oxygen, if it becomes what we call hypoxic, it doesn't function properly. Or at all. Obviously, there are lots of things that can cause a brain to become hypoxic, including even a planned medical event like general anesthesia. But another cause may be labor and the way a woman has to push. You take in these very deep breaths, work very hard, and then you exhale at once. And you do this for hours. Suddenly, before you know it, your brain is going hypoxic.
Is this dangerous?
Absolutely. If you strain enough and become sufficiently hypoxic, your heart can slow down or even stop. It's a sort of reflex mediated by the vagus nerve. Your heart stops, and you pass out. As some doctors say, you vagal out.
Can you die?
Oh yes, indeed one can. But women in labor almost never do, because a delivery room nurse or an OBGYN knows exactly what the early symptoms look like. And it's very easy to treat. You simply have the laboring woman relax for a bit, or in an extreme case, you administer oxygen.
What makes you think Charlotte vagaled?
First of all, she evidenced the symptoms of a person going hypoxic. Then, when we were looking for injuries to brain cells, we saw significant evidence of hypoxia.
So you're saying Charlotte Bedford was forced? You're saying Charlotte Bedford pushed for so long, she went hypoxic? She vagaled?
Yes.
In your opinion, was that the cause of death?
Well, that's the thing.
I don't think so. Why not?
This is going to sound pretty ironic, given the reasons we've all assembled here, but I believe Mrs. Danforth saved her life after she vagaled. I'm convinced that the CPR Mrs. Danforth performed, all those cycles, actually brought the woman back. Dr. Tierney's opinion was not a surprise to our family, but it was a revelation to most of the crowd.
What makes you think so? Tanner asked when the room had settled.
The amount of blood in the peritoneal cavity, the abdomen. I mean, there were close to 750 milliliters in there.
Over 2 pints?
Roughly. Plus there was all the blood outside of the wound, on the bedding, and of course on that pillow Mrs. Danforth had used to soak some up so she could see what she was doing. In my opinion, there would not have been that much blood in the deceased's abdomen and around the bedding if the woman had been dead when Mrs. Danforth tried to perform a cesarean section.
And so you believe Charlotte Bedford was alive when Mrs. Danforth performed the cesarean?
That's correct.
In that case, what was the cause of death? How did Charlotte Bedford die?
Dr. Tierney sighed and then looked right at the jury. As I myself typed on the death certificate, the final one, she died of hemorrhagic shock, caused by the cesarean section. In my opinion, it was Mrs. Danforth's C-section that killed her. I don't toss and turn. It's not like that. Sometimes I don't even remember listening to Rand's breathing for hours. But in the morning, it's often like I haven't slept. I'm cranky and tired, and I go to rooms that are empty and cry. Stephen says Charlotte's sister doesn't hate me. But he's not a woman. He's never been through labor. He's never seen life surge into a room at birth. On this one, he's wrong.
From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife.
I wanted Stephen to tear Tierney apart. I knew the medical examiner had been a devastating witness. But I also understood that if Tierney's damage could be undone, most of the repair work would have to wait until the following week, when Stephen would put our own experts on the stand. Then, I hoped, everyone in the courtroom would see that Dr. Tierney was merely the Vermont coroner. He wasn't from Boston or New York City. Tierney's opinion was only one among many, and his was most certainly mistaken. Eventually, the jury would be convinced that Charlotte Bedford had been dead beyond question when my mother decided to rescue Little Vale. Stephen, of course, would curry no favor with an Orleans County jury by undermining Tierney simply because he was from Vermont. And so most of his strategy during his cross-examination of the medical examiner late Friday afternoon was simply to lay the groundwork for his own forensic pathologists and to suggest that there was going to be wide room for disagreement.
You testified that Mrs. Bedford had about 750 milliliters of blood in her abdomen. Am I correct? He asked at one point.
About that, yes.
If someone approached you and said a woman had died as a result of a cesarean section done under these circumstances, wouldn't you have expected more blood?
Tierney thought for a long moment. Finally, I might have. Thank you. If you wanted categorical, indisputable, irrefutable proof that a cesarean section had been the cause of death, how many milliliters of blood would you want to discover in the abdominal cavity?
Tierney nodded his head slightly as he pondered his response.
Perhaps 1,000, he said. Was there that much blood in Charlotte Bedford's abdominal cavity?
No.
Thank you, Stephen said, and he started back to his table. No further questions. For a brief second, I thought this would mark the end of the day, and therefore the week, and I grew excited. This seemed to be a wonderful note on which to send the jurors home for the weekend. But before Stephen had even retaken his chair, Tanner was on his feet for the prosecution's redirection.
Two quick questions, Dr. Tierney, if I may, he began. Given everything else you learned from the autopsy, and given the huge amounts of blood that were found outside of the abdominal cavity, such as all that blood Mrs. Danforth soaked up with the pillow, was 750 milliliters enough to convince you that the cesarean had been the cause of death?
Yes, most certainly.
Given all of your experience, and all of the time you have spent on this particular case, do you believe the cause of death was the cesarean section performed by the defendant?
Yes, I do.
Thank you, Tanner said, and Judge Dorsett looked up at the clock on the far wall. It was well after 5, and the first week of my mother's trial was about to be gaveled to a close. Before we all left the courthouse and went our separate ways Friday evening, Stephen tried to reassure my parents that this would be the low point of the trial for us, literally in terms of what my mother's prospects for acquittal appeared to be, as well as emotionally. After all, the state had presented virtually its entire case. The only remaining witness was the widower himself, while we hadn't even begun our defense. Stephen warned us that during the weekend we could become alarmed. Remember, there's still a long way to go. The last thing he said, before he climbed into his car, was that he'd see us on Sunday, when he and Peter were going to come by and help my mother rehearse her testimony and prepare for the cross-examination. As we drove back to Reddington, my mother asked me how I was doing. I lied and said fine. Actually, I was fighting back tears. As we approached our house, we saw in our headlights a conga line of parked cars just to the side of the driveway. The Vermont midwives, some of whom must have left the courthouse before Dr. Tierney finished his particularly lethal interpretation of events, had brought us dinner. Cheryl and Molly and Danelle and Megan and Tracy, names that will always conjure for me effusive women who hugged on sight and could love without question or reservation or inhibition, had come to rally around my mother. Even Cheryl Visco, whose frequent presence at our house throughout the summer had come to annoy my father and me, was a welcome sight. When the midwives and their families saw we'd arrived, they started to clap for my mother. Cheryl put an arm around her shoulder and led her into the dining room as my father and I trailed a step behind them. Suddenly, someone had stopped applauding long enough to give my mother a glass of wine and my father a scotch, and someone else was handing me a cold soda. I looked up to thank whoever had offered me the glass, and I saw it was Tom Quartz.
"How did you know about this?" I asked.
"Your mom's friend Cheryl called and got a hold of my mom," he answered, and motioned toward the older midwife. I looked at the way she had begun cradling my mother in both of her arms, and at the smile she had somehow elicited from her, the sort of broad grin we rarely saw from my mother those days, and the tears I'd been fighting since we left the courthouse began streaming down my cheeks.
"Hey, you're home," Tom said nervously, unsure why I was crying and what he should do. "Everything's going to be okay now." I shook my head, sure that nothing would ever be okay again. And then I took him by the hand and led him upstairs to my room, where I cried in his arms until all of my mother's friends finally left our house for the night, and the floor below us grew still.
I hadn't seen Asa Bedford since before his son was born and his wife died. When I saw him Monday morning, he looked like hell. Although he had never been a handsome man in my mind, he had always been so kind with Foogie and Charlotte, and so thoughtful of Raleigh and me, that there was something attractive about him. The Asa Bedford who was about to testify, however, looked tired and beaten and unendurably sad. He'd aged, and he'd aged badly. As he had with Anne Austin, Tanner had the father recall step by step what he had witnessed the night and morning his son was born.
"You never saw her confirm that Charlotte was dead or that the baby was alive before she began the C-section?"
"No."
"She just plowed ahead?"
"Yes."
I had gotten used to seeing Charlotte's family in the courtroom by the second Monday of the trial, and as I glanced over there as their brother-in-law told his version of what had occurred,
I could see in their eyes the fact that we, Sybil Danforth and her family, were going to lose. Certainly there were times during Stephen's cross-examination when my spirits would lift, when, for example, with painstaking detail, Stephen enumerated all of the reasons why Asa Bedford could not have seen blood spurt or his Charlotte bleed. But when Stephen was done, I still knew we were finished. Asa, after all, was a minister. As powerful as I thought the medical examiner's testimony had been on Friday, even a coroner's credibility pales before a pastor's. The cross-examination lasted most of the afternoon, and when it was complete, Tanner had a brief redirect. And then it was over, and the state rested. Stephen never doubted my mother would be an attractive and compelling witness, but he did not want her to be the final witness. He wanted her sandwiched in the middle, between the road crew members and character witnesses who filled Tuesday's dance card and the medical and forensic experts who either believed in their hearts my mother did the right thing or were at least willing to say so for the right fee, lined up for Thursday. Stephen said he wanted my mother to occupy the middle third of our defense so she would be an accessible presence, a woman with a voice, for the jurors during most of it, especially the critical conclusion when our expert testimony was being presented. He hoped to complete his defense in 3 days. His principal objective was to be done by the end of the week, so the jury wouldn't go home for the weekend with the fear that the trial was going to drag on forever. And so we began. Graham Tuttle, Lawson plow driver, told everyone how impassable the roads were on March 14th. The phone company's Lois Gaylord confirmed the hours the phones were down. Our accident reconstructionist reassured the jury that my mother had indeed spun out on the ice in the Bedford's driveway, and a physician used photos to explain the cuts and bruises my mother had sustained on the slick surface. By lunchtime, Stephen had done what he could to convey that my mother was trapped with the Bedfords, and there was absolutely no way they could leave for the hospital. What Stephen could not do with this particular group of witnesses, of course, was undermine Tanner's contention that she should never have been trapped with the Bedfords in the first place. That a capable and trustworthy midwife would have checked the weather and learned of the oncoming storm, and then chosen to transfer Charlotte Bedford to the hospital the moment her labor commenced. In theory, that responsibility would fall upon the character witnesses planned for that afternoon. It would be up to them to refute any suggestion that my mother was not supremely competent and incontrovertibly reliable. And most of them did a pretty good job, especially B.P. Hewitt, my mother's backup physician. Hewitt endured a cross-examination that would have withered most people.
"If Sybil believed the woman was dead, then I believe the woman was dead," he told Tanner at one point.
"Were you present at the autopsy?"
"No."
"Did you examine Charlotte's medical records after she died?"
"No."
"Had you even examined her at any point in her pregnancy?"
"Nope."
"You really have no idea, then, what you're talking about, do you?" "Objection!"
"Sustained."
"You really have no detailed understanding of this case, then, do you?"
"Oh, I think I do. I think I understand how a labor develops, and..."
"This labor. Not any labor. This labor."
"I understood your question. You asked me if I had a detailed understanding of this case. Well, I do. And I don't believe it's Sybil's fault."
"Your Honor, would you please instruct the witness to answer the question?"
"In my judgment, he did."
Tanner was flustered for a moment, but the moment was brief. He stared at his notes, caught his breath, and quickly regrouped.
"Okay," he continued finally. "Why do you feel you understand Charlotte's death so well?"
BP shook his head in astonishment.
"Come on. I'm Sybil's backup doctor. I have known Sybil Danforth for close to a decade, and I know what she has told me about this incident. If Sybil tells me the woman was dead when she did the C-section, then in my mind, the case is closed."
It would not be accurate to write that, the night before she was scheduled to testify, my mother feared she was going to be convicted. The word fear suggests that the prospect frightened her, and I think by Tuesday night her fear, and her notebooks indicate that there were moments earlier when she had been very scared indeed, had been replaced by numbness and shock. Rather, the night before my mother would take the witness stand, she simply expected that she was going to be convicted. My father, on the other hand, was frightened. I was sitting on my bed about 8:30 when my father knocked on my door, and I told him to come in.
"Your mom just went to bed," he said, putting his coffee mug down on my desk. "She wants to get a good night's sleep for tomorrow." "How about you? Tired?"
"Yep." "You've been a dream through this,"
You know, I rolled my eyes, trying to downplay the compliment. A dream? Corny, Dad, very corny.
I'm getting old.
Yeah, right, he nodded. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that your mom and I are proud of you. We're proud to have you with us through this whole thing.
What do you think will happen?
Tomorrow, or when it's all over?
When it's all over.
He sighed. Oh, we'll just go back to leading a normal, incredibly boring life. And we'll love it.
So you think they'll find Mom innocent?
Oh, yes. And if they don't, we'll appeal.
Have you and Stephen talked about that?
It's come up, yes.
He left a few minutes later. When he was gone, I tried not to read anything more into his visit than his desire to offer his daughter praise. But I did. Before I even thought about what I was telling Tom, I heard myself portraying my brief exchange with my father as further proof that my mother was going to be convicted, telling my boyfriend that the very idea of a family life in the coming years that was normal and incredibly boring had become my father's idea of a fairy tale.
Why don't I go with you to the trial tomorrow? Tom said.
You shouldn't miss school, I told him. But I liked the idea of Tom in the courtroom, knowing I could turn around and see him there, and I hoped he'd ignore me and skip school. Everything had become for me a dramatic portent of evil. Later that night, when I was finally going to sleep myself, I heard my parents making love in their room, and even that seemed to me a sign that the end was nearing. I put my pillow over my head so I wouldn't hear their bed in the distance, and so the pillowcase could absorb my tears. And as soon as the white cotton grew damp, and I felt the wetness on my cheek, I was reminded of how my mother had used a pillow to soak up the blood inside Charlotte Bedford, and then my tears became sobs. My mother wore the green kilt she had worn the day the trial began, and she put back her hair in the same cornflower blue hair clip. As she sat on the stand, she looked to me like a professional and a mother at once, a mother too young to have a teenage daughter. Moreover, because a witness stand tends to exaggerate both a person's aesthetic strengths and weaknesses, my mother's exhaustion gave her an almost heroic-looking stature. To the jurors, of course, she might simply have looked guilty. She might simply have looked like a tired woman who couldn't sleep because of the blood on her hands. But at least in the first 2 hours of her testimony, she spoke well. She was eloquent when Stephen asked her to explain why she had become a midwife, and why helping women to have their babies at home was important to her. She sounded like the most reasonable person in the world when Stephen asked her about the role hospitals usually played in her practice. If I see a danger, I will never let a mother's desire to have her baby at home, even if it's a really powerful desire, cloud my judgment. If there are any indications at all that the baby is in distress, I will always transfer the woman to the hospital.
What about the mother?
Same thing. If there's a problem developing, we'll go to the hospital. And as reasonable as my mother sounded when she discussed hospitals, she was every bit as confident and unwavering when she offered her version of what had transpired on the morning of March 14th.
Did you check one last time to see if the woman had a pulse? Stephen asked.
Yes.
Did you hear one?
No.
Did you check one last time to see if she had a heartbeat?
Yes, absolutely.
And did you hear one?
No, I did not.
You did everything possible to make sure the woman was dead?
Oh, yes.
What about the baby? Did you check to see if the baby was alive?
Yes, I did. I listened for a heartbeat with a fetal scope, and I heard one, she answered, looking directly at Stephen as she spoke.
Where were the father and your apprentice when you checked? Were they with you?
No, I think they were still in the kitchen.
Getting the knife?
That's right.
So they never saw you check the woman or the baby?
No.
But you did?
Yes, for sure.
Mid-morning, Tom Courts arrived in the courtroom, and I was both surprised and glad. There were no seats left, and so he stood beside one of the court officers near the door, with his back flat against the rear wall.
It was sometime near 11 o'clock that my mother's answers started sounding less precise, and some of her responses began to grow slightly fuzzy as the adrenaline that had gotten her through most of the morning began to dissipate. When Stephen asked,
"Did the father try and stop you?"
she volunteered an answer that I know wasn't part of the script. Asa was a husband, as well as a father, and no husband in that situation would be in any condition to make any kind of decision.
But in your judgment, he made a conscious decision not to stop you, correct?
Correct.
Before the day began, I had worried about the cross-examination, but never about my mother's direct testimony. I did now. I did not believe my mother wanted to be convicted, but as the morning drew to a close, some of her responses almost made it sound as if she no longer cared. Unfortunately, Stephen didn't dare end her testimony, because then the cross-examination would begin before lunch. I think Stephen thought it was paramount to keep her on the stand until close to noon, so the cross-examination would not start until after lunch and he could use the noon recess to buck up her spirits and get her refocused. Just before 11:30, while still in the midst of her direct testimony, she slipped into one of her answers a sentence that none of us expected. It changed everything, and everyone in the courtroom knew it changed everything the moment she said it. Hastings. And the father was still beside the window? Danforth. Yes, he was sitting in the chair there, holding his baby in his arms. Anne was right beside them. From where they were, they could see there was a body on the bed, but I know they couldn't see the incision, and I was glad. I thought it would have been too painful for them to have seen it. I don't recall actually turning out the light by the bed when I was through, but I looked at my notebooks the other day, and I saw that I had. Stephen immediately tried to clarify what she meant, asking, "You mean your medical notebooks, correct?" But it was too late. "No," my mother answered slowly, her voice meek with shock. She knew instantly what she had done, and she knew what would happen. "My personal notebooks. My diary." There was no dramatic rumble or murmur in the courtroom, because we were all too stunned to speak. All except Bill Tanner. With a voice that sounded almost ebullient, he asked the judge if he could approach the bench. "This is the law. In the discovery process in the state of Vermont, Stephen Hastings was under no obligation to inform Bill Tanner that my mother's personal notebooks existed or to turn them over to the prosecution. This is the fact. My mother had told Stephen soon after they met that the notebooks existed, and he had read some of them, at least some of them, maybe whole years' worth. When he saw that some of the entries from mid-March could be construed as incriminating, he told her to stop keeping what was in essence a personal diary and to never speak of the diary again until after the trial. She said she would abide by both requests and then ignored both, one by design and one by accident. My mother was simply incapable of not keeping a diary. She had kept one throughout her entire adult life, and it was probably unrealistic to expect her to stop chronicling her actions and emotions in the midst of the worst stress she would ever experience. And so the state had seen the medical records my mother kept on her patients, but not what she referred to as her notebooks. The four attorneys and the court reporter huddled around Judge Dorsett in a bench conference that lasted 18 minutes. When it had become clear to the judge that the discussion would last more than a few moments, he had had the jury escorted from the room for the duration of the debate. When Stephen returned to his table, he looked glum. It was a short walk from the bench to his seat, but in even those few steps, it was clear he had lost, for the moment, his one-click-above swagger. Judge Dorsett ruled that he wanted all of the notebooks from March forward in his hands by the end of the lunch break. The trial would be recessed until he had inspected them himself in camera. In his chambers. "I will decide what, if anything, is relevant," he concluded. He then told us all that the jury would be brought back into the courtroom and that my mother would complete her direct testimony. When she was finished, we would adjourn until he had reviewed the notebooks. Did I know exactly at that moment what I would do? I don't believe so. The idea was only beginning to form. But with merely a vague notion, I still knew what the first step had to be. I leaned forward off my seat on the bench, and I tapped Peter Grinnell on the shoulder. When he turned to me, I whispered, "Look, if you need any help, I'll go with you. I know right where they are." It was Patty Dunleavy who was sent to Reddington to get the notebooks. I went with the investigator, trying to disregard the way my head was filled with the sound of my beating heart, focusing solely on what I had read late into the night the Wednesday before. I tried to remember which dates were the most incriminating, which entries were most likely to be, as the lawyers and the judge euphemistically phrased it, relevant. As I recalled, there were probably three loose-leaf binders that would matter to Judge Dorsett. The March entries were toward the end of one notebook,
early April through August were in a second, and August through September formed the beginning of a third. Those were the notebooks I would need to bring back to the courthouse. Fortunately, when my mother had begun keeping her notebooks years earlier, she had chosen to use three-ring binders and loose-leaf paper. Moreover, at some point, she had gotten into the habit of beginning each entry on a separate sheet. I would definitely remove the March 15th entry, because I knew there was another one on the 16th that also talked about Charlotte Bedford's death.
I'd have to check to be sure, but I thought there was a chance it was on the 16th that my mother wrote about where Asa had been holding the baby and where Anne had been sitting. And there were those entries further on in the summer, the ones in late July and August and even September, where the doubts in her mind had become so pronounced that they were no longer doubts. She was almost certain she had killed Charlotte Bedford. Those entries would have to go, too. I think initially Patty was going to keep her car running while I ran inside our house, but I heard her turn off the engine while I fumbled with my key in the front door. I had to go to the bathroom, but I didn't dare take the time then. I went straight to my mother's office and found the three notebooks the judge would expect, and laid them out upon my mother's desk in a row. I would move chronologically forward from March. I was shaking as I worked, a precursor of sorts to the trembling I'd experienced while we awaited the verdict. I wasn't sure what law I was breaking, but I knew what I was doing was illegal. And I knew what I was doing was wrong. When I returned to Patty's car, I was still shuddering. I dropped the three notebooks onto the floor below the glove compartment and pushed them to the side with my feet as I climbed in. Five loose sheets of paper, folded down to the size of a paperback book, were pressed flat against my stomach, hidden under my blouse and my sweater and my jacket.
"Is that everything?" Patty asked, glancing down at the notebooks on the floor mat.
"That's everything," I said, the first of at least three times I can recall that I told that particular lie. By the time we returned, the court had recessed. Before taking the binders with him into his chambers, the judge told us he would let us know by 1:30 or 2 whether we could all go home for the day or whether the trial would resume mid-afternoon. If we were told to go home, it meant he was probably going to allow some or all of the notebooks. Stephen, I could see, was prepared to lose. He was prepared to lose both on the specific issue of the notebooks, and I think he was prepared to lose the case. He knew what my mother had written in March, and perhaps early April. He probably knew that it only got worse. And I think my mother was ready for defeat as well. I didn't believe at the time that my mother had slipped on the stand with a conscious hope that it would ensure a conviction. And even today I don't think she hoped for one on an unconscious level. But I think she had become resigned to that inevitability. Given the guilt in her own mind, she must have viewed her notebooks as all the evidence the state needed to convince the jury she had killed a woman in labor. The difference in my mother's and Stephen's attitudes is that Stephen still had some fight left in him. He was already modifying his strategy for his expert witnesses. It didn't matter whether Sybil Danforth thought Charlotte Bedford was dead or alive, because Sybil was merely a midwife. Our obstetric experts and forensic pathologists were positive, based on their years and years of medical experience, that the woman was dead by the time my mother made her first cut. The principal issue he would have to overcome was my mother's testimony itself. Carefully, he had elicited from her the idea that she had done everything she could to see whether Charlotte Bedford was dead, without ever having her say categorically that she was sure beyond doubt that the woman had died. My mother hadn't lied, but if the notebooks were allowed, it would look to the jury as if she had, and not even Stephen Hastings' experts would be able to restore her credibility. Consequently, our lunch was an extremely quiet affair. While the fears of the adults around me began and ended with the issue of whether Judge Dorset would allow the notebooks to be admitted as evidence, I, of course, had an additional worry. When I'd gone to the bathroom at the restaurant, I'd considered ripping the pages to shreds and flushing them down the toilet, but I was afraid. If the judge discovered they were missing and insisted that they be presented, their continued existence might be my only hope for clemency. But it was not merely my fear of the judge that prevented me from destroying them. At some point, I assumed, my mother would get her notebooks back. Although it was unlikely I could ever press the folds from the pages and replace them in the diary before she noticed they were missing, at the very least I could still return them to her. But I did read the pages once more in that bathroom, and as I did, I reassured myself that I was making the correct decision.
I had to do everything I could to protect my mother and preserve our family. Besides, my mother's conviction would not bring back Charlotte Bedford. It would merely destroy a second woman. The judge ruled that there was nothing in the diaries that was relevant to my mother's testimony specifically, or to the case in general. Did Judge Dorset, who could stare directly into Stephen's and my mother's faces, see that in addition to relief, there had to be surprise? He was an intelligent man, so I'm sure he did. I'm sure he saw disbelief in their eyes. My mother knew exactly what she had written at different points over the last 7 months, and they both knew what she had written on March 15th. My mother and Stephen must have thought that they had been given, inexplicably and without reason, an astonishing gift from the judge, a gift that grew tangible when a court officer carried the three blue binders to the defense table and handed them over to my mother. A moment later, the jury was brought back into the courtroom, my mother was returned to the stand, and Bill Tanner began his cross-examination. I cannot undo what I've done, or what I might have done. I don't think there's anything left for me to set right. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. Tanner's cross-examination was often brutal and occasionally mean-spirited. He was angry that the notebooks had not been shared with the state, and his fury was fresh. Yet my mother endured and even snapped back at Tanner a number of times. I wouldn't categorize all of her testimony as spunky, but there were some particularly spirited exchanges, and she had regained the clarity of mind she had demonstrated early that morning. And Tanner never asked the one question I dreaded, and in all likelihood, the one my mother and Stephen feared most. Is there absolutely no doubt in your mind that Charlotte Bedford was dead when you performed the caesarean? But Tanner had no idea what my mother had written in her diary, and so he assumed there was none. Asking her that question in front of the jury would only hurt the state's case by giving her yet one more opportunity to say Charlotte had already passed away when she chose to save the infant's life. Although there were occasional sparks that afternoon, my mother's cross-examination and the remainder of the trial seemed anticlimactic to me. Wednesday night, I carried my mother's notebooks into the house from the car for her and offered to return them to her bookcase. "That would be lovely," she said. "Thank you." I flattened the pages that I'd removed as best I could before I returned them to the binders, but it would always be clear that someone at some point had removed some entries. Apparently, she did not add anything to her notebook that night, and she was so tired she never even looked at the books before going to bed. The next day, Thursday, our obstetricians and our forensic pathologists all said in one way or another that in their opinion my mother had not killed Charlotte Bedford. But Bill Tanner also made sure each witness acknowledged that he had received a fee for his opinion, and that these opinions were not based on having done, or even having seen, the autopsy. And then, on Friday, the attorneys gave their closing arguments. The arguments were over by 10:45, and the jury had their instructions from the judge by 11:30. They began their deliberations before lunch. We expected a long deliberation, and so we went home. I overheard my father ask Stephen what it would mean if the deliberations went into the weekend.
"This whole business has a lot of great myths," he said to my parents. "Usually, a long deliberation doesn't bode well for a defendant. If a jury is going to send someone away for a long time, they like to make absolutely sure they don't have any doubt about his guilt. And that can take time. But I've also seen cases, even first-degree murder cases, in which it was all pretty cut and dried, and the jury came back with a conviction in 2 or 3 hours.
"And this one?" my father asked.
"I haven't a clue. But there was a lot of so-called expert testimony they have to wrestle with, and to me that suggests they'll take their time."
"The weekend?"
"There's a chance. But for all we know, the minute you get home, you'll get a phone call from me saying to turn around and come right back."
"Are you going back to Burlington?"
"Nope."
"You're staying in Newport?"
"I am." "So in your opinion, there's a good chance they'll reach a verdict this afternoon."
He shrugged.
"I'd hate to get all the way back to Burlington and have them reach their verdict around 4 o'clock. That wouldn't be fair to you."
"To us?"
"Judge Dorset won't allow the verdict to be read unless I'm present. And you don't want it read unless I'm present. If I couldn't be back here by 5 o'clock, 5:15 at the latest, he'd have to wait until Monday morning to have the verdict announced. And that just wouldn't be fair to you, Sybil, to any of you."
"No,
I guess it wouldn't, my father agreed.
Nope, not at all.
Those great myths, my father said. Are there more? Stephen smiled.
Well, some lawyers think you can tell how the jury has ruled the moment they re-enter the courtroom after their deliberations. If they look at the defendant, he's going to be acquitted. If they refuse to look at him, if they're unwilling or unable to look at him, he's going to be convicted.
In your experience?
In my experience? Don't believe it. It's just a myth.
Do you want to join us, Stephen? My mother asked. Do you all want to join us? It'll only be sandwiches, but...
Stephen thought for a moment, looked at his team, Patty and Peter and the law clerks, and then at my father. I'm sure my father wasn't happy about my mother's lawyer and entourage descending upon his house once more, but the invitation had come from his wife, and so he offered Stephen a small smile.
Sure, Stephen said.
That would be nice.
My grandmother sat in the back seat of our car and asked me innocuous questions about horses and Tom Quartz before figuring out I was uninterested, perhaps incapable, of conversation. All I could think about were the ostensible myths Stephen had shared with my father. I wish Tom were there, but he had gone to school that day. The phone rang constantly that afternoon, which was an enormous source of frustration. The calls were always from reporters, or my mother's friends, and by 2:30 my father was snapping at them all without discrimination, and no one who heard him could blame him. Sometimes I heard people talking about the notebooks, but my mother never went to her office to look at them, and I was relieved. She still hadn't discovered what I'd done. We were called at 3:20 with the news that we should return to the courthouse. No one would venture a guess in my mother's presence what a 4-hour deliberation actually meant, but I know I was feeling for the first time in well over a week that there was a chance my mother would be vindicated, and it almost seemed that Stephen had regained his swagger. But no one would speak of such things to my mother. In one of the strangest exchanges I heard in all of the months before the trial began, and the 2 weeks of the trial itself, my grandmother asked my mother as we drove back to the courthouse, "Have you ever considered putting in another window in your examining room? I think the extra light would make the room much more cheerful." "I haven't," my mother answered, apparently contemplating a future somewhat different from our fantasies. "But maybe someday, when those prenatal posters are gone, I'll hang some nice flowered wallpaper. Wallpaper with irises, maybe. Lots and lots of blue irises." Looking back, I think it was the sheer speed of the deliberations that led to my cries in the courtroom. By the time we had returned to the courthouse, I had concluded that my mother would be found not guilty on the one charge that mattered, involuntary manslaughter. I don't think I really cared whether she was found guilty of the misdemeanor of practicing medicine without a license. Yet as the jury was being led in, that changed. That changed completely. None of the 12 jurors would look at my mother. They looked straight ahead of them as they walked. They looked at their shoes as they sat. They looked at the clock on the wall. They looked at the lake. "Please be seated," the judge told us when the jury was back. "Good afternoon," he said to the group, and then turned to one of the court officers. "Miss Rivers, do you have the envelope with the sealed verdict forms?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
"Would you please return that envelope to the foreman?"
My mother sat unmoving between Stephen and Peter, her hands clasped before her on the table. Beside me, I saw my grandmother's hands were trembling.
"Mr. Foreman, would you review the envelope with the forms?"
The foreman had one good hand and one with only a thumb, but over the years he had apparently become fairly dexterous with his 6 fingers. With the disfigured hand, he used his thumb and palm to hold the envelope, and with the other he flipped through the papers.
"Are they the forms you signed? Are they in order?" Judge Dorsett asked.
The foreman looked at the judge and nodded, and still none of the jurors would offer my mother a glance. Not one brief glance. They wouldn't even look at my father or me.
"Please," I prayed to myself. "Please, look at me. Look at my mother. Look at us. Look here. Look here. Look here."
But none would. None did. And then one, the elderly woman in the red flower dress, looked toward Bill Tanner, and I knew it was over, and we had lost. My mother would be found guilty. My mother would go to jail. My theft of pages from my mother's notebooks had merely been one more meaningless gesture in a meaningless tragedy. Charlotte Bedford was dead, and my mother's life was essentially over. She would go to jail, she would never catch babies again, and that's when I started to cry.
It wasn't simply the pressure that caused me to scream and sob. It wasn't the waiting or the tension or the stress. It was the idea that the roller coaster ride was finally coming to an end, and it was coming to an end with a long chain of cars, some holding Bedfords and some holding Danforths, smashed on the stanchions that were supposed to carry us all high above the craggy horrors of the earth. I was not present when the verdict was read. I was with my grandmother and Cheryl Visco and Patty Dunleavy in a small conference room far down the hall. I have been told that when the judge asked my mother to stand and face the jury, Stephen helped her to her feet. Some of those present tell me that he held her elbow as the verdict became public, but others aren't so sure. With my father right behind him, I don't believe that Stephen would have done such a thing. But I was wrong about so much. He may have. If my mother believed the myth about juries Stephen had told us earlier that day in the parking lot, and if she had noticed that none of the jurors would look at her, then she may have been surprised by the verdict. I am told she nodded her head a tiny bit and sighed, and my family's relief was manifested much more visibly by my father. He murmured a "thank you," so loud that people in the rows far behind him could hear it, and looked up toward the ceiling in gratitude and relief. A long second later, when everyone in the courtroom had absorbed the verdict, there was the sort of spontaneous reaction that the judge chose not to stifle. Charlotte's sister and mother and the midwives started to cry. The midwives cried with joy, while the Fugits sobbed for their dead sister and daughter and friend. Some of the witnesses who had been kept from the courtroom through the largest part of the trial, people like Asa Bedford and Ann Austin and B.P. Hewitt, were in the room when the verdicts were announced, but none of them showed much reaction. Not even Asa. He hugged Charlotte's mother and rocked her, but his face remained impassive. Later, Bill Tanner would try and suggest that although my mother had been acquitted on the charge of involuntary manslaughter, the jury had still sent an important message to midwives about home birth. They had found her guilty of practicing medicine without a license, a signal that he said meant Vermont juries were not at all enamored with the idea of home birth. That evening, however, neither the midwives nor my father cared that my mother had been found guilty of the misdemeanor. A $200 fine was absolutely nothing compared to a manslaughter conviction, and once more the adults played the music loud at our house, while I curled up on the couch in their midst and sipped herbal tea till close to midnight. Even 7 years after my mother's trial, many of her midwife friends feared that my decision to go to medical school would be seen by many people as an indictment of home birth. It was not. I became an OBGYN, at least in part because a woman's right to choose to have her baby at home was important to me, and I wanted to be sure there were always doctors on call who would support that decision. I know there were other reasons as well, but those reasons are more difficult for me to articulate. They begin, on some level, with a desire to be around babies that is so strong it may be genetic, but they go deeper still. A need to know without reservation exactly when someone is alive and when someone is dead. Atonement. A desperate distaste for the whole idea of a C-section, combined with an occupation that will demand I perform the operation with regularity. Reparation. Compensation. Justice. Some of my mother's midwife friends are aware that I have been writing this book, and they fear now that my recollections will be tinged by my profession. If they knew what I know, if they had seen the notebooks and knew that I had stolen key entries, they would be more than fearful. They would be furious. They would most certainly not want this tale told. But on the second Wednesday of the trial, my mother's story became my story too. I know now my mother would want our stories told. She discovered that someone had folded pages from her notebooks the Monday after the trial was over, just after I had left for school and my father had left for his office. Apparently, her first thought was that Judge Dorsett had removed them from the binder to read them carefully, and he was the one who had creased them. But the idea that the judge had spent any time at all with those entries and then ruled the notebooks were irrelevant didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense at all. And so the idea crossed her mind that someone else was responsible, and that someone probably was me. Mid-morning, she went to the general store for a newspaper, and her suspicions about me grew more pronounced. Toward the end of a news analysis of the trial, one of the jurors brought up the notebooks.
We all knew the judge was reading her diary during the recess. That was pretty clear, the juror said, and so we expected we'd get to hear what she'd written. But then the judge read it and didn't see anything incriminating in it. I can't speak for everyone else, but that mattered a lot to me.
When I returned home from school, my mother confronted me. She said she honestly didn't know whether she should be disappointed in me or proud beyond words. On the one hand, she saw in her daughter a teenage girl who would read someone else's private diaries and then have the audacity to break the law and obstruct justice. On the other hand, she was astonished by my courage and the risk I was willing to take on her behalf. She said she loved me either way, but then asked me a question that revealed yet one more emotion churning inside her. What do you think now of what I did? I told her I was glad she had saved the baby, but my answer was meaningless. We both understood it was the question that mattered. It was the inquiry that made clear the way our lives as mother and daughter were forever changed. I was 14 years old, and I knew my mother's worst fear. She never even told my father what I had done. She told me we would never again speak of what had become our crime. And until she was diagnosed with lung cancer 2 years ago, we never did. It wasn't until her third afternoon of chemotherapy, one of the days that I drove her to the oncologist in Hanover, New Hampshire, and kept her company while the poisons were dripping intravenously into her arm, that she brought up the name of Charlotte Bedford. "Is she why you're becoming a doctor?" my mother asked. "Or am I?" "Both, I guess." She nodded and watched the clear tube where it merged with a needle and then her skin. "I haven't opened my notebooks in years. I boxed them up when you went away to college. You probably knew that, didn't you?"
I rolled my eyes. "I guess I did."
Not long after she paid her fine, my mother returned to midwifery, and for a year her life was filled with activity, if not exactly joy. There were the prenatals and the consultations, the women. But then her new clients started coming to term, and she had to start catching babies again. She discovered during her first delivery that the almost bewitching pleasure that birth had once held for her had been replaced by fear. Every time she encouraged a woman to push, she thought of Charlotte. Every time she placed a warm hand on a laboring woman's belly, she was reminded of the imaginary line she'd once drawn with her fingernail from Charlotte's navel to her pubic bone. And so she stopped. She delivered her last baby on an afternoon in November and was home in time for supper. We knew it was the last birth, and my father toasted my mother and all of the beauty she'd brought into the world. For a short while, a rumor circulated in Vermont that my mother had left the profession she loved because of some agreement with Asa Bedford. The rumor implied that neither he nor the Fugits would press a wrongful death civil suit against my mother if she agreed to give up midwifery, but there was no such agreement. Asa decided against a civil suit almost immediately because, as he was quoted as saying in one article, he was not interested in knowing the monetary value of my Charlotte's life. Besides, Asa was a good man, and he was a minister. He knew as well as anyone to whom revenge really belongs. Nevertheless, my mother never did catch another baby. Exactly as she had told her own mother she would, she pulled down those prenatal posters and covered the walls of what had once been her office with blue iris paper. She then read in that room, and she quilted in that room. For a few more years, she kept writing in her diary in that room. And then suddenly, she boxed up the binders and carried them up to the attic. I came home from college the Christmas of my freshman year, and I looked in on her study and saw the notebooks were gone. "Do you know where I put the notebooks?" my mother asked me as the toxins dripped into her arm. "The attic, right?"
"Right. They're yours if you want them, when the time comes."
I tried to laugh. "Mother, don't be morbid."
"I didn't say the time is coming tomorrow, but I want you to know they're yours. Do with them as you will." She was told she was in remission a mere 4.5 months after her diagnosis, but the remission lasted barely a season, and she died 5 months after the cancer returned. Of the men in my life, the year I turned 14, it is only my father I continue to see regularly. He still lives in Reddington, and I've joined a practice in central Vermont, and so we've been able to have lunch or dinner at least once a week since my mother died. Tom Quartz did escape his family's automotive garage. He left for one of the state colleges while I was in high school, and we broke up soon after that. But our paths crossed periodically as adults, because he works for a company that designs software for the medical community. He also attended my mother's funeral, a gesture that moved both my father and me. Tom is married. I am not. Someday I hope I will be, too. Until recently, I continued to see Stephen Hastings' name in the newspapers and his one click above strut on television. No more. Apparently, as he has gotten older, he has chosen to do less criminal law. For a long time, my family received holiday cards from his firm every December, and for a few years they included notes that Stephen himself wrote. But then the notes diminished to a salutation, a wish, and a signature, and then the cards themselves stopped coming. I don't believe my father missed them, but I am sure on some level my mother did. I have never spoken to the Fugits, but I did speak once with Asa Bedford. I went to see Mobile and the towns around it like Blood Brook, and I learned that Asa had eventually remarried and returned to the pulpit in an Alabama coastal town called Point Clear. I hadn't gone to Alabama planning to visit Asa, at least not consciously, but when I got there the desire to see him was almost overwhelming, and so I called him from a payphone at a convenience store. He said he and his wife would be hurt if I didn't come by the parsonage. And so I did. And the three of us had iced coffee, and Asa and I spoke of our lives in the years since the trial. Fugi, I learned, had recently moved to Texas so that he and his wife could be closer to her family. He was about to become a schoolteacher. And Vale, the little baby whose life my mother had saved, had grown into a handsome young man who, if he didn't exude such health and vigor and strength, would be the spitting image of his mother. When Asa walked me to the door of the modest little house, we stood at the screen for a long moment, and then he hugged me, patted my back, and wished me peace. From the Notebooks of Sybil Danforth, Midwife. March 15th, 1981. The room was really quiet. It was like even the ice and snow had stopped banging against the window. For a second, I was aware of this chattering, and I looked around figuring that Asa and Anne must have heard it too. But they didn't, because it was in my head. It was my teeth. My teeth were actually chattering. The room was perfectly warm, but my teeth were still chattering. I looked down at my hands, and they were trembling so badly the knife was shaking. And so I inhaled really slowly, and then exhaled. When I cut into Charlotte, I didn't want to be shaking so much I couldn't control the knife and accidentally hurt the baby. I then made a line with my fingernail from Charlotte's navel to her pubic bone, and reminded myself that doctors did these things all the time without hurting the baby. I've seen lots of C-sections in my life, because most of the mothers who I transfer to hospitals end up having them, and never once have I seen a doctor nick the fetus. So I told myself I just had to be incredibly careful, and then I went ahead. I just did it. I pushed the tip of the knife firmly into the skin. I don't think anyone but me saw the body flinch. At the time, I just thought it was one of those horrible postmortem reflexes that you hear about in some animals, and so I went on. I thought the same thing when there was all that blood, and it just kept flowing. After all, I checked for a pulse, and I checked for a heartbeat, and there hadn't been one. So how could she have been alive? The fact is, she couldn't, I thought to myself, and she wasn't. That's what I thought as I drew the knife down, and I know I was absolutely sure of that then. But looking back on it now, a day later, after I've gotten some sleep, I just don't know. Whenever I think of that flinch, I just don't know.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Midwives by Chris Bojalian, read by Kate Burton. This program was produced and directed by Terrell Meyer. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Abridgment by Virginia Noonan. Text copyright 1998 by Chris Bojalian. Production copyright 1998, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.